Are we ready to start?
I think we're ready
Just
to
gonna hang
start.
out.
Right, this is it, isn't it? It's episode 10, season 1. This is the this. I need to bring up the old HBO stuff. The HBO guides still haven't
worked
out.
Oh yeah, I want
out.
To see what that looks like now.
Yeah, what does
the character guide's
got
to be
all
updated with who's deceased now and who's not, or who's more deceased.
Well, we have lost. Come on, load in. Luceris? Yes. And he has been updated as deceased.
So. Okay, so he definitely did die.
Rest in peace.
During that.
Sweet pieces. Summer child.
Sweet summer child.
Rest in pieces.
So
he survived. He's living his life as a simple fisherman now. He lost his memory. He has amnesia.
No, he's alive inside the dragon's stomach. He's just sitting there.
He walked out at the last minute and will be raised by a red priestess.
No, but that's a conspiracy theory. People have
really
it's mentioned in Fire and Blood that Luke survived and lost his memory.
Yeah, all the fan theories, the delightful, sweet fan theories.
It's because we want our nice characters to live, right? Like it seems, particularly in House of the Dragon, that like all the people that you kind of want to live die, right? Mm-hmm. Like the two good strongs. Now Lyseris.
Laenor. Laenor lived.
Mm-hmm. Rhea Royce. She seemed pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's, you know, this is setting up a tragic conflict, I am assuming. So you've got to have the, like, you've got to build the likables so that they can be tragically killed.
I think the only person who I kind of felt all right about dying was maybe Vaemond. But I don't think Vaemond was like a bad dude. I think he was just, for want of a better expression, trying his luck.
He's just ambitious. He's just outspoken and ambitious.
He was,
you know, I think from his perspective, he was like, I must speak the truth. Like, this is my honor to, like, this is how, like, you know, I'm not like my family be degraded by bastards. Like,
yeah, you know, like it wasn't, it wasn't, he didn't do anything monstrous.
No.
So, you know,
he spoke the truth.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's one thing going for him, isn't it?
I mean, technically, Rhaemyra is not a whore. Like, she wasn't paid for her promiscuous nature, but...
No, but you would be...
technically true.
I mean, if... I mean, if she was not loyal to your nephew, you can probably kind of see a bit of anger there, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, he thinks his family's kind of getting played. He probably feels somewhat laughed at. For like letting this stand, so I don't know, I chalk that down to being relatively neutral, maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Understandable, you know. I can kind of see. I, you know, maybe I'd do the same thing.
It was foolish to say it in front of Daemon in front of the court, because, you know, he must have known Daemon would just do what he did.
Yeah.
We've also got lots of new kids listed on the character guide now too. Including
we
the
do.
One that died in this episode. But we also have another kid listed between... Right, we have Daeron Targaryen, who doesn't have a picture yet.
Yeah, so that's Alicent's youngest. So he's been on the Bloodstream, as in the opening credits, for quite some time. But he's not been introduced. But all of the behind-the-scenes people say he will turn up. Basically, he's been fostered at Old Town.
Yeah, Daeron.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we have a lot of people with the same name again.
I know.
The other kids. Get ready.
This is. I mean, I love that George R. R. Martin breaks a lot of rules. You know, like in Game of Thrones, he famously broke the rule of just having too many important characters, right? Like, he didn't just break the rule a little bit. Like, he just threw it out the window, right? and it was like, it was a well-known thing that everyone, like, with Game of Thrones, is like no one knew who anyone was because there were just so many people, right? The only people who knew who each people was either book readers who have had a lot longer to acclimatize to the material, or absolute like weirdo nerds such as us, right? Like, it's just normal people don't get that, and they break the rules here by having so many characters with like very name. Similar names. Like, it's just like, you can't, like, for the sake of storytelling, anyone with a modicum of sense would have like easily recognizable names that might, in some way, there might be a very vague linking in of onomatopoeia a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Like, something to help remind you.
Who's who and who's related to.
Yeah. Like, it's...
Yeah,
it's,
definitely. The first time I watched Game of Thrones, I think it took me three attempts to watch it, because the first time I watched it, I was like, nope, this is not PG. I do not sex and violence, no. And then I was like, but it seems really compelling. And everyone told me it was good, so I'll try again. And then the third attempt, I got through the series, and then I read the books, and I'm so glad I did, because I think if I read the books without having had some vague association of the characters from the series, I think I would have struggled, because I like, dyslexia brain anyway, I've already got name blindness.
Yeah, it's so much universe building in your head to be able to, like, read those books and then try to picture all that stuff that happens.
Although I'll say one thing that does help a lot for me, I don't know if anyone else feels the same way about this, the maps help. Like, if I've got a map and I know where stuff is and where stuff's going on, like, that tends to make things really make sense, which is a little bit why maybe I don't click in quite as well as House of the Dragon, because there are fewer places. And the places that we do see are kind of like, feel kind of similar, like Driftmark and Dragonstone feel a little bit similar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're a bit like islands. Coastal. Yeah, Sailory, you know? This is just another
We got to see some of the map in this episode. Mm. With that, like, part where they lit all the candles, which shows the map, right?
Well, yes. I mean, it's funny that, like, with a smart guy like Tyrion around, Daenerys didn't manage to, like, activate that feature.
Stannis never figured it out either.
No. And he had a fire priestess about with him. You'd think she'd just be, like, kicking off fires.
Yeah, exactly. So,
I still think that, like, it would be kind of neat, but I doubt they do this, but it would be kind of neat if some point, maybe through this show, they got rid of the they got rid of the extra swords, right? Like there was like a plot linking in, a plot reason why it goes from one aesthetic to the other, the two Iron Thrones in the two series, if you know what I mean. Because in the book, of course, it doesn't.
I think they're going to address it. I think it's going to happen.
You reckon they'll just like tidy it up a bit?
Yeah, I think probably like the fact that Alicent has already like adjusted the throne room to like add more of the stuff of the Seven. I wouldn't put it past her to be like, oh, just tidy this up a little bit.
I mean, yeah, like I don't want to be missed. You know, I don't want to be that health and safety guy, but like, you know, and you'd free up. There'd be so much more room for activities if you got rid of all those swords.
Yeah, I mean, I think there might be a slight continuity error. I need to rewatch the wedding sequence, the wedding episode, because I feel like the wedding episode, they put the, like it was set in the Great Hall, and they put, like, the main, like, banquet table for the royal party right in front of where the throne would be. Which, what about all the swords that were poking out on that, like that raised plinth? Like, it was one of those things I kind of vaguely noticed at the time, but now we're discussing it, I'm like, was that a continuity error, or was the depth perception off?
Or this is a weird, I could be very wrong on this one, are the swords like, can you put them away when you want to lower a table and then you bring them back out? Are they like little little bases or something where it's just like...
It's like one of those fields that you can convert between, like, a soccer field and football field.
Exactly, or, yeah.
You know.
Or do they have it under the floor and they just swing it up from the floor and it's hanging upside down underneath? Don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe all the swords are from IKEA and they're all just flat-packed.
Mm, exactly, yeah. And there's probably, like, some sort of string or toggle that just flips them up.
Sounds accurate. Those Targaryens, they're very progressive on their... practicality.
Yeah, and like, I mean, I get that, like, if this ends up just being a show thing, that's fine. You know, like, it's all fine to have, you know, stuff that's like just for the show, especially when it is a visual sort of storytelling type thing. the, you know, like it, like I'd be totally happy with it if it, as maybe something like Alicent would do, because that sounds like something, you know, someone of the faith might do, right? Someone who's a bit like, you know, balls deep in it might sort of put away some of the swords, because you probably don't want, maybe you don't even want that aesthetic, because, you know, there are like plot reasons. Like, for example, if Alicent and Aegon and Otto Hightower want to give the appearance that they are the peaceful ones, they might start like putting away some of these swords, if you know what I mean. They might like start like, you know, cleaning up their image, as it were. Less conqueror, more, you know, peacemaker type of thing.
I mean, it's like, Otto said in the episode that, you know, they are fully aware of all the symbology of legitimacy. I wouldn't put it past them if their political messaging is, because at the moment their political messaging is quite aggressive. It's the conqueror's crown with the conqueror's sword, with all of that jazz. While Rhaenyra's is a little bit less aggressive. It's the crown that was her father's and her grandfather's. But otherwise, her political messaging hasn't really. She hasn't called her banners, but I think that's the hint of the end of the episode. So I think her political messaging might become very aggressive, and I think probably Alicent's, given the fact that they technically have started this conflict by causing the death of Lucerys, I think Alicent's response might be, oh shit, peace, we totally didn't do it, we're totally like, we're the good calm ones, holy moly.
So when Lucerys died, right, I thought immediately, that's like, you know, from like almost from Daemon's point of view, where it's like, because he thinks that they killed Viserys, right? Like he says that was almost like his instinctual accusation. It's like they killed him, which obviously, like, I mean, it's not like he was a, you know, a spry chipper or anything like that. Like he was on death's door at the best, you know, like. But anyway, so Daemon's like, at least, at the very least, has some strong suspicions that they killed Viserys. And then suddenly Lucerys turns up dead as well. And it's like, I bet Daemon's going to interpret that as a foregone conclusion that they're just on the outright offensive and they don't care who gets in the way. Whereas from Alicent's point of view, I don't know how, like, with, so, you know, how much good faith you want to take on board with that, but it's like, she's lost her husband, and of course, Lucerys dies in an accident. It's like, I don't know. It still seems. Yeah, one is much worse than the other.
It highlights the discrepancy that Alicent had with her small council, in that she was like, we need super peace, we need super peace, we need to end this peacefully. And all of her council was like, war. And I think Daemon is very much in the same boat as the Green Small Council. And I think Rhaenyra even says that, like, everyone around that table is, you know, pushing for war. And the only one who's not pushing for war is Rhaenyra until, you know, the first stone is thrown. So, like, I think Daemon very much, like, I think, again, Rhaenys is just... The quote at the beginning, which was like, all of these boys, they're green and, you know, they've got fists of steel and balls of seed and they just want to war because they're green. I think that plays true for everyone on either side of the council except for the queens, until they are provoked, and provoked through miscommunication, provoked through tragedy. So it feels very, you know, Greek tragedy. And, you know, if Rhaenyra and Alicent could have talked, if the dragons hadn't, like, it's just like a cascade of tragedy. Particularly this, like, obviously we've seen Alicent was grieving the whole way through the last episode because of the death of her husband. And then we've got Rhaenyra grieving the whole of this episode because of the death of her daughter, and the death of her father. The different, like, tragedies where they're both women in power who are trying desperately to hold on to peace despite their own personal strife, and if they could just communicate, if only iPhones were a thing, and
communication,
like,
is key.
Counselors, yeah,
it's like the dragons are the ones that lit the spark for the war too. I mean,
yeah,
they did ride them out there. And Aemon did decide to, like, pursue and poke the bear with the stick even more. But ultimately, they both lost control of their dragons. Like,
I was going to say, regarding the losing control of dragons, do you think it's the dragons didn't listen, or that the dragons, like they were reacting instinctually to the circumstance, or, you know, or do you think the kids are just not very good dragon riders? What's your theories?
It could be that. I mean, they were flying through a thunderstorm. I can't imagine that being very, very good in terms of the balance of power. Like, the fact that, like, that is how it started, and then it was, like, all sunny and clear and fine up top, but the dragons wouldn't have changed their mood that fast, you know? Like,
It
was Jacera's dragon that struck first, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I need to rewatch the scene Arroyo? For a couple of reasons, because I feel like one thing I want to track, given, again, Chris is kind of... I don't necessarily agree, but it's an interesting theory about the use of language to control the dragons. Because I don't know at what point... Like, I need to go through it with subtitles and track when they did and didn't use Valyrian. Because it seemed like, instinctually, when the kids were panicking...
They did.
They stopped using Valyrian, they started using Common.
Yeah, because
it could be miscommunication with the dragons. Or it could be... My other theory is, like, instinctually, like so Aemond was just there to be, like, bullying him, basically. Like, I've got the, you gave me a pig years ago, you made me feel small, guess who's the big powerful one now? Ha ha ha, bully, bully, bully. And...
Is that your, is that how bullies work to you, is it, Jenny? Go, ha ha, yeah, bully, bully, bully.
Bully, bully, bully. I'm so tired. But yeah, so he wanted to... just basically have fun at the expense of Lucerys, not anything to do with, like, actually hurting him, maybe taking his eye, but definitely not killing him. But if you make a dragon who is, at least on some level, a instinctual beast, feel cornered, it's going to potentially snap. And that's, I think, what happened, where the dragon blasted some fire at a much more aggressive large dragon, and then instinctually, the large aggressive dragon was like... I'm like an ancient dragon. What the F? Of course, I'm going to nom.
The first time I think that they didn't speak in the language was when Lucerys yelled no at Arax, and that was where the first fire blast happened. I'm pretty sure, because before that, Aemon was speaking in it, but he was yelling, like, for Lucerys, because the subject said, like, boy, and then, like, where'd you go?
Going on the debate of how much of it is independent dragon instinct, how much of it is core Valyrian, and how much of it is a psychic link. Is there was an interesting thing with when Rhaenyra was having her messy, horrifying birth. They kept showing flashes of Syrax.
Oh yeah, they did.
Syrax, like shots of Syrax's face and, like, growling and that sort of thing while Rhaenyra was in pain. So to me, that read as confirmation of some level of a psychic link between dragon and rider.
Yeah,
that would also suggest that if the boys actually had intention to cause harm, whether, like, subconsciously, like, if Aemon subconsciously actually want Lucerys dead, and the dragons are actually able to read those primal motivations regardless of language, then, like, it's just taking into account that instinctually... that's actually what Aemon wanted, was to kill him. It's the first time we've had an implication that there is a real meaningful visual implication that there is a psychic connection between dragons and their riders. From that shot.
I think it's like, and I think this might be something to say more towards how magic is done in House of the Dragon versus how it might be done in Game of Thrones. So there's this sort of, like, maxim in Game of Thrones where it's like dragons bring about magic, or they are a symptom of magic in the world, right? So when dragons are about, other magic is a bit more alive as well. But we don't see any magic, I think, in House of the Dragon, right? No visual actual magic, right? Am I
wrong? When Rhaenyra left the castle with Daemon to have their flirty, sexy times. There was like a guy doing fire magic, and there was a lady who was like, "Do you want your to know your future of your death, child?" And that was just on the street. So I think there is an implication. There is
No, is it have we seen? Yeah, but those are parlor. Those are at least assumed to be parlor tricks, right?
Parlor tricks. We haven't seen any black candles. We haven't seen any warlock type things.
We haven't seen any Melisandre shadow babies
or fire priestesses.
No. It's all so been it's
more
implied,
person to person related. Like, yeah, it's been more like about the dragons and the people, less than
it's invisible, right? So, because it to me, it seems very much implied but not explicit that Laris can walk into the rats. Right, because of how they cut from one to the other, how one things are in the background, all that kind of stuff. But it seems to me that the show wants to keep this very much suggestive, so that, you know, almost a sense of plausible deniability in this kind of thing. And I kind of feel like it's the same there with dragons and the psychic connection. It's like there may or may not be a psychic connection, but it's implied, not explicit, and the implication of it, the suggestion of it, the unconfirmed nature of it is the kind of the tease, right? That's the important part, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be that people are so in tune with their dragons that you might think there's a psychic connection. But the thing is, I think this is where it kind of where they might sort of cleverly shuffle about that ruse a little is with the dragon fight at the end, right? So obviously between Aemon and Lucerys, right, they have a reasonably complex history of power dynamics and revenge and all that kind of stuff that quite possibly could just be lost on a dragon, and that dragons, they don't really necessarily understand the concept of a relationship that complex or even care to know or whatever. And so whereas Aemon thinks that he's got the hubris that he can manipulate his dragon that much, maybe the dragon just takes it as a attack rather than a soft one, as a tease or a bully or a, you know, and or it's just simply,
yeah, it's not intellectual, it just senses the energy his angry energy, his primal force, and then if the dragon matches that, I mean, in any relationship, right, one side can have the upper hand in terms of the energy power. And that's the idea that, like, maybe in Aemon's anger, the dragon also gets that energy. And then because it's more experienced than he is, maybe it takes that upper hand in the energy. And then he can't, it's in control of the dance. And, like, because he fed it that energy, he can't do anything about it. He can't control it. Especially if he's controlling it using words instead of feelings, which is probably the main way it's controlled.
Like, you know,
language.
In the same way, if you're, I've never owned a dog, but when you're, I imagine if you're training a dog, like, you're, like, there is a certain amount of the animal you're connecting with, reading your experience, reading your body language. Like, you know, got my friend who's got a sad, like, if you get home sad, her puppy will come and just sit on her. wouldn't necessarily say anything different or anything like that, but would just come and sit on her.
Right.
So I feel like there maybe will be that instinctual connection, regardless of if it's fully magically psychic or just that instinctual relationship to read body language and intention.
Mm-hmm. But it's also not a person. In the same way a dog isn't a person, too. Mm.
Yeah. Like, they're intelligent, some people, but they are bestial.
Right, exactly. But it's also like there are some people that, like, when they walk their dog, if they don't even know that they're giving off very nervous and, like, tense energy, it's also reflected in the dog that they're walking, and they may not even realize that the way that they're modeling is also being reflected in their dog.
Yeah.
That same way might be true of the dragons, like, because they're not people, they have a connection, but the action of the animal might also reflect, right, the inner state of the person, even if the person's unaware of what their state even is. They're not aware of paying attention.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's how I read it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Ultra Chiefsex's live stream commented on kind of the unintentional cascade of negative emotions. So mm-hmm. the parents have created an unnecessarily, like an unintentional cascade of emotions down to the kids that even at the point at the dinner party where they were willing to resolve their issues, their kids were not. And then the kids, whether willing or not, have chosen to, like, have cascaded their emotions onto their dragons. And it's kind of an upwards cascade in terms of power. It's like, you know, if you are causing unintentional fallout, but your fallout is, you know, to giant fire-breathing lizards, it's a recipe for tragedy.
Mm. Yeah, it's also, like, I don't know, I kind of get it that it's like a cat playing with a mouse. Like, the dragon's gigantic. And that dragon tiny.
God, yeah,
and
like
it's like so easy for the power dynamic to switch in the direction of the dragon that's massive, you know?
Like, it really was just a nom, that death.
What's the difference between them? I don't even know, like...
It was gargantuan.
I think they're a size difference.
Obviously, one of them's older than the other one, you know? Mm. Right?
Hundreds of years.
I mean, the obviously they were trying to, like, almost like a lot of the point of what we were shown on screen was to illustrate dragons are not equal, right?
Yeah.
And because I loved the direction of scale in this episode, to be honest. Like, they did a lot of it for obvious reasons because they're setting up all the battle stuff and then they're demonstrating that, you know, this one's big, this one's tiny by comparison, right? Especially the difference between the ones that are the ones that are
cradle
old.
Hatched versus
cradle
hatched versus inherited. Yeah. And I love the fact that the way they shot it was very kaiju, like it gave me like King Kong like Godzilla vibes, like that level of just sheer size of frame.
Yeah, I was getting Godzilla vibes when
the shadow in the clouds.
Yeah, the shadow in the clouds, and also as is it Luceris was going into Dragon Storm's End.
Yeah, that shot was beautiful.
It was amazing, and I got to think though, right? Because they do talk about how much they spent on this season. I like that was a great shot, but it didn't look like it would have cost that much money because it was very like silhouette-y and perspective-y. Yeah. And it's like, I got to be honest, thinking about the last 10 episodes now, which fair play have actually been 10 proper episodes. They haven't like slimmed it down or anything, and it is the longest episode of Game of Thrones outright, or not the longest season. The episodes were the longest and there was 10 of them. But the thing is, it doesn't feel like they spent more on it than season 8 of Game of Thrones, but they did. Hmm. And it's like, that's kind of strange. Like, am I wondering where the money has gone? Like, am I like failing to appreciate, you know, there were some shots that looked really good. Like there were some like sweeping, what you might think of as drone shots going across Dragonstone that I thought were absolutely beautiful. But was that it? You know, is that the kind of, are those the kind of scenes that are costing the big bucks?
Maybe they spent it on the cast.
I mean, you're supposed to take into account that this was probably shot. When was this shot? Was this shot during COVID?
I think a lot of it was, yeah.
Yeah, because if we take into account production costs during a pandemic, like the amount of coverage they would have had for like the well-being of their cast and crew, like that could have been a factor. But you do have these, you know, they have built some more large and intricate sets, which are practical. Like a lot of the armor, I think, is really like there are quite a few really interesting details, as well as the dragon budget, because even in like the last season of Game of Thrones, Daenerys had her dragons on screen not that much, and they've really cut down the direwolves. Well, this has got to have at least a dragon scene, quite a large dragon scene, or plus more than one dragon scene per episode. I don't know. I couldn't tell you where the budget is because I can't see the breakdown of it, but I would say it's at least equal. I can understand why it's at least equal, and I couldn't say specifically why it would be greater.
Mm. It's just something that sort of like ticked at me. It's like, well, I was expecting at least one big big battle. Well, yeah, because even was the Stepstones it? I guess maybe.
I guess yeah. I guess that was the most battle that we saw out of all first season was that Stepstones battle. Yeah, I mean the dragon was like igniting people on the cliff edges, but you didn't really get any dragons fighting one another except for I think this last episode. Really.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair though, I mean the first Game of Thrones season didn't have a big battle in it, but and I, it's hard to say whether or not it suffered for it or not because you're only ever looking at it in the context of the full show, right? So this yeah. is like season one of Game of Thrones, really. It's like the whole first season is the prequel,
mm-hmm.
which kind of makes sense why they were so quick to confirm a season two. They just wanted to know that the potential viewership was there. They might even understand yeah, so no. much that this might not even be the best season. This might not be the one that's most popular because the first season of Game of Thrones, most people picked up Game of Thrones are a couple of seasons in.
Yeah. I think that was when it really had its takeoff as well.
Yeah.
Because it had to do so much setting up because the world was so complex. Like I will say for this show, because Game of Thrones did so much of the groundwork, even though they're... Like they didn't need to do nearly as much chunky exposition as Game of Thrones season one had to do, in terms of like they had to specify who, like they had to make it really clear whose family is whose, but like they never explain who the Hand of the King is, like simple things like that, which are, you know, for us second nature because we watched the first Game of Thrones series, so they don't need to explain who the Hand of the King is, who the Council is,
right.
You know, those sort of things. So I think. The writing, I think, is stronger than season one, but I think it could still hit a stride in season two when it's not got so much jumping.
Sorry, do you say the writing in House of the Dragon season one is better than Game of Thrones season one?
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. In terms of like sheer quality, there was some dialogue in season one, which was quite
rough,
exposition-y, isn't it? Like, you know.
Yeah.
And
I think that they can only get away with this series having a more deep, concentrated story because of the groundwork that was done in Game of Thrones. I think, you know, if they didn't have Game of Thrones, they would be explaining who Targaryens are and why they have dragons, and they would explain like who the Hand of the King is, and they'd be, you know, the religion of the Seven. Like to us, we know exactly what that is. We know who the Maesters are. Well, in Game of Thrones, they kind of had to build that in or expose it.
Yeah. Yes, although to be fair, they do that in Game of Thrones over a very long, like episode one and the first couple of episodes, like the dialogue really does stretch and distort a fair bit because of the exposition they have to get across. But like the Faith of the Seven is like rolled out over a long period of time, but. What I like about House of the Dragon is they set everything up so that it's a bit of a show don't tell. Like they don't explain the small council not nearly as much as they do in Game of Thrones, but they kind of don't need to because it sort of explains itself in a very natural way. I feel I could be wrong.
Overall the writing is. I feel like just. It's more dense and interesting and complex, and the subtext that they like, things like the conversations that Tywin would have, where he's playing like when you get Tywin and Olenna Tyrell in the same room and they're having a conversation about one thing, while there's an entire other conversation regarding the subtext of the scene happening at exactly the same time. Like I feel like that was the whole of the series the whole way through. There is so much that there's not a scene that isn't playing at least two strings.
I mean, some of Rhaenys's dialogue is particularly well when it comes to that kind of layering.
Oh, she's brilliant.
She has.
Rhaenys has got powerhouse of a character.
Very interesting. And her dialogue is particularly, quite well written. I mean, to be fair, the only... I mean, any complaints I've got the show are going to be incredibly minor, but they're also going to be things that they've left, like they haven't done. I think in terms of what I don't think they've done very much badly, but I think in reality, the only thing I would say it was missing was any kind of like levity and humor.
I need some levity. Yeah, I think the closest we have to levity, which is probably the reason why Rhaenys is one of those characters that just like sings, is, you know, she kind of has like, even at her most serious, she has an air about her. Like there was a shot in this episode where Daemon is being sassy and Rhaenyra sends them all out, and there's just this filler shot of Rhaenys kind of smiling to herself, being like, "Oh, yeah, here she goes, a queen who's got a husband who wants to do his own thing. Will she be able to put him down? Like just that knowing look on her face was." And there was a scene in, I think it was episode 3, where Viserys makes the trip to Driftmark to propose the marriage to between Rhaenyra and I've forgotten his name.
Corlys,
his son. Rhaenys just kind of Laenor. And Rhaenys just kind of floats in, and she's wearing like a baggy shirt, and she's like, "Cousin, lovely." And she's kind of got like this kind of like really truly self-aware air about her, more than a lot of the other characters, because she was kind of, I think, like, she has a wisdom that none of the other characters have, because she was not chosen.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't really have, like, obviously her family's in the game, but she doesn't really have a like money on the game. She's just there to kind of spectate and give wisdom, and so sometimes she just has that look about her of like, yeah, you go, Rhaenys. You've got like the wisdom of understanding beyond all of the other characters in the show.
Well, she is maybe one of the older characters. Although I don't know how much older than Daemon she is, but she's also quite far removed even from Daemon, her nearest Targaryen relative. So I think, and like, given that the Grand Council at the beginning, mm-hmm, I think she's just all out of fucks to give, really.
Yeah,
you know,
and I love it.
Yeah, she's kind of like, she's got a bit of wisdom, and she hasn't really got much to lose. Like she seems not hugely unhappy with Corlys. Like she seems to be quite happy as a Valyrian, right?
In comparison to the other romance, like marriages in the show, I think Corlys and Rhaenys probably have the healthiest. Because even if we're going back to Viserys and Emma, like he didn't really listen to her, and she didn't really, you know, push her wants. And then we have obviously Helena and Aegon are terrible for each other. He's awful and she's a sweet bean who deserves better. And then you have obviously Alicent and Viserys, which was not a healthy relationship. Yes, there's some joy to be had from it, in that she did care for him for many, many years, and clearly cared for him, if not in a romantic, loving way. But other than that, I can't think of any other marriage. Well, I suppose Rhaenyra and obviously in this episode, it really highlights that Rhaenyra and Daemon, their relationship is not great. I feel like Rhaenyra and Laenor's relationship was probably the closest to actual happiness, and he was clearly deeply depressed and very unhappy, and they weren't able to have successful sex. And she had to seek comfort elsewhere. So in terms of a working relationship, probably theirs was the best. But in terms
good colleagues, yeah.
Yeah, they were great. She was a fantastic beard for him.
I mean, in this episode in particular, we got a pretty firm demonstration of how Rhaenys is listened to in a relationship as well. Like, even though, you know, you've got a highly patriarchal society, you know, as sort of the obviously weaves itself throughout the entire storyline, and Corlys is part of that patriarchy, and he, I'm sure, I feel, very much sees himself as the father slash head of the household type of thing. He still talks to Rhaenys as an equal, and still seems to like respect her intelligence, with, you know, wisdom and opinion.
I feel like she can speak her mind to him in a way that not necessarily all others like other women in their patriarchal relationships can necessarily do. Yeah. Like she doesn't have to do, like, you know, with Rhaenyra and Laenor, at one point she had to invoke, like, I am the royal heir, you must do what I say. And I don't think Rhaenys, like, Rhaenys doesn't have that power, but she doesn't need it.
Yeah. So it's I started off being a bit prickly about her in the earlier stuff, in the earlier episodes, but I've really warmed up to her now because she kind of sees the bullshit for what it is, right?
Yeah, she's fantastic, and she's always done it. It's just she's been too minor to really pay attention to. But I feel like the best, probably, like, it's just, again, another tragedy on this Greek tragedy that probably is the story, is that if she had been queen, she'd actually been allowed to be queen, what a different world would it have been?
Yeah.
But that level of wisdom, insight, intelligence, down-to-earth common sense, and a flipping dragon that's cool and badass, what a different world it would have been.
But like, it's the path not
Alicent
trodden.
Alicent is right. Yeah, like, Alicent is right. Like, Viserys should have become a country lord who, you know, lived his life, and he shouldn't have been king. Rhaenys should have been queen. The grass is always greener, but
yeah, we don't know if it Rhaenys has spent a substantial number of years, like, learning from Viserys's mistakes, right? And also, to be fair to Viserys, like, he generally kept the realm in a reasonably steady state. Like, I don't think he was a bad. I think, like, when him and Lionel talk about, give a bit of a review of his reign, like, something that's relatively uneventful and stable, it is good. Like, the best kings probably aren't remembered because they just keep things ticking over. Like, the best king is a bit like the best IT person. Is like, it's best if they just, like, don't interfere in your, you know, like, the less you know about them, the less prominent they are, the better, you know?
Maintainer of stability, yeah, you don't, it goes over well, but you don't get remembered because people remember disasters.
People remember disasters, people remember war.
What was the Viserys, the title they gave him at his funeral, was Viserys the Peaceful?
That's the one, yeah.
Yep.
Like, you know, he was adequate, although, interestingly, in this episode, there was that interaction between Lucerys and Rhaenyra at the beginning, and he said, you were always perfect, which is clearly, you know, the blind spot of a child. But, you know, her saying, I was really scared, and then my father taught me how to be a ruler. And that threw off alarm bells in my head, because I'm like, did Viserys really teach Rhaenyra how to be a ruler?
Mm.
Like, we haven't seen a single scene in the whole of the period where she is a child where he actually talks about politics to her and talks about, like, how things are meant to work, other than the duty based on her gender in terms of marrying and the line of succession and the prophecy. Like, we never actually have had a single scene of him actually training her to be a ruler. The progression as she went from a cupbearer to a member of the council. But he, as far as I can tell, he never actually taught her anything. So I think she might be looking a bit rose-tinted at her childhood.
Well, I was to take that the cupbearing was her training. Also, is cupbearing not a substitute for education now? Is this some modern thinking?
I mean, I'll be interested, because obviously her perspective when she was a teenager was, ugh, I'm just a cupbearer, he never listens to what I say, any suggestions I do he ignores, or he sends me off to do this, or he sends me off to do that. How much of that was active, like, passive teaching, and how much of that was inactive? Like, how much of that was just happenstance? By happenstance of her being in the same room, she happened to learn how politics work. I don't know. Again, we just never had a scene where he actually is teaching her how to be a good politician. So I don't know how much of that is, again, like, rose-tinted glasses for her, or it could be, but, like, his politics weren't great. It's very clear that he let the rest of the council kind of run it while he was on planning the next thing or being very, very ill. So, like, I'll be interested to see how her political stylings are. Or it's kind of sad, because I wish we could have seen more of her political stylings before she goes into wrath mode. Because I've got the feeling season 2 is just going to be anger. and not too much political smarts. While I feel like she could have been politically interesting, or it would have been good to see whether she could be politically interesting, given that Viserys wasn't politically interesting, or politically interested, at the very least.
Mm.
Just a food for thought, as mm-hmm. I often do. For large dragon. Hom nom 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 hom.
I do have to think that I thought it was actually quite kind of adorable during the war councils Baela Targaryen, Rhaena Targaryen went up with Jacarys and Lyserys. They did that in a kind of a like a
they're cool.
Yeah, like a
it's, yeah, it's courtly dating.
Courtly dating.
They seem happy in each other's company, which is nice to see in relationships. Is people happy in people's company? Because we have had a couple of I think part of the reason why people were surprised with the Daemon Rhaemyra interaction in this episode is most of the interactions we've had since they've been married have been quite courtly and happy and contented.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously Daemon does not know how to handle grief. I think it's possibly the understatement of his character. He can't do emote. He only does rage.
Yeah. Well, he would be because he's a psycho. Like, he has killed a wife before. Like, let's not pretend mm-hmm. this guy isn't.
Yeah.
Let's not pretend.
Pretty this guy easily. Is, pretty easily killed.
Isn't what
pretty
he is. Killed right? her. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like, again, depending on where he goes in season two, I think he could be a really good example as the trope of the guy that people think is redeemable, but is just and always will be an abuser. Or at least a toxic, violent man. a toxic, violent person. because, you know, we kept on seeing moments where he, in like just a few scenes where he is really like sweet and kind to Rhaemyra, and we're like, oh, maybe she has redeemed him, which is a dangerous trope.
Oh yeah,
and a dangerous thought process.
She fixed him; he's fine.
And then clearly is not the case.
Yeah, unless you can unmurder wives, you can't fix him, right?
You put them back together. Just stitch together the skull.
Nothing but necromancy.
That's what these sisters are for.
Yeah.
Called a red priestess.
I did read an amusing headline, which is House of Dragon showrunners don't know why people like Daemon so much. It's like we keep trying to demonstrate what a bad guy he is. In this episode, he murders his wife. In this episode, he cuts a man's head off.
They're in love with half of him.
I mean, we've seen him cut off a number of body parts in this series.
People see what they want to see. You know, they can just block that part out.
Your favorite neighborhood dismemberer.
your local, dismemberer. Reasonable prices, half off.
You know how, with the Lannisters, Tyrion was like the redeeming Lannister.
Mm.
Well, Daemon is like the unredeeming black, as it were. You know, person from the black side, right? Like,
he's like they. How good
they? Sorry, we both started buffering there. Go ahead, Jenny.
You go. It's fine.
It's just like on the black side, like they have everyone seems relatively kind of cool except for Daemon. Whereas, like with the Lannisters in Game of Thrones, everyone seemed kind of a bit evil except for Tyrion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a certain level of when you've got a actor who's loving it as much as Matt Smith is. Like, there is a level of natural charisma that comes with the character. B, I think that's a credit to the writing that they have, like, he has motivated reasons for being the shit he is. That's what, how you get great villains, is having motivated villainous actions. So he's motivated by the fact that he wants his brother to pay him attention, and he's motivated by the fact that he feels constantly overshadowed by other people. And now I think probably one of the things that we will probably see coming to next season, I would not be shocked, is he feels overshadowed by the fact that his wife is the actual heir. Yep. Well, he is not. And I think that's already starting to come into play. Like, she is the destined prophecy heir. And his brother never even told him about this prophecy that apparently was something that he was obsessed with.
Right.
So I think that jealousy and that envy is going to really play a part. And I think possibly part of his, a tiny bit of perhaps his motivation in this episode is the fact that, like, Rhaemyra clearly goes through something deeply, deeply traumatic in the loss of her father and her child, and is then back on her feet and doing the business and telling him what to do. While he can see that that's an incredible feat of power, and it's genuinely impressive. And I think he is a bit envious that he isn't coping as well. I think it's down to, you know, when you're having an emotional time, you don't necessarily see that other people are suffering in the same way you are. And I think Daemon, because he is self-absorbed, he doesn't necessarily see the truth of the grieving situation that Rhaemyra is going through in the same way that he is going through the grieving situation. I don't know. I feel like that there's some disconnect in that. But my third point on why Daemon seems more likable than he is because he embodies a lot of the toxic masculine traits which are prized in this universe. Like, he is a warrior who is ruthless and powerful. He has a powerful dragon. He had like in the lore of this universe, like, we keep on going, well, you know, he was in an unhappy marriage and he's got to produce heirs, and his wife was clearly a bit of a bitch. Yeah, we can let that, like, you know, you can almost imagine the other cat, like, his gold cloak sitting around the table, like, oh, your wife is uglier than sheep. He embodies a lot of the things that this world's culture covet.
Yeah. There's a lot of,
like, if he was less competent at doing what he does, then there would be a lot less sympathy for him. I think if he was the equivalent of I think a shadow character to compare him to would be what's he called? Theon Greyjoy. So Theon Greyjoy. Mm-hmm. Has issues, he likes violence, he likes sex, he has a lot of the things that he prizes, but he's not competent. He can't cut off a head, he doesn't have a powerful sword, he doesn't, like, he's not able to commit to his depravity, and we see him as kind of pathetic and kind of a bit meh. And then obviously he gets more depressing as we go, but I feel like because Daemon is deeply competent at what he wants to do and he is driven, I'd say he's a high charisma character. He knows what he wants and he goes for it.
So he's the successful Theon. That seems to be a
commendable trait.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. Like, he embodies a lot. Like, Theon, like, he is what Theon would want to be perceived as, and Theon is not that competent. I feel it's not a perfect comparison, but that's kind of what I'm trying to explain.
No, I get you.
I don't know what I'm saying.
It's like the poster child ego. Like, he's just...
Yeah.
The good image and the power. And he's interesting. It's what makes him an interesting villain, honestly. He's competent and I feel like villain.
Like, for example, if he were to have a Jaime-type arc where he were to lose his hand or his ability to fight or his ability to ride a dragon or something like that, I think that would shatter him from an emotional standpoint because he would lose one of the primary things that makes him feel competent and powerful. And unlike Jaime, where we then root for him more because he's having this progression, I think we'd root for him less because I think if Daemon was... God knows what Daemon would do if something took his power hold from him.
Well, that's kind of interesting because, you know, there was this theory about Game of Thrones that Tyrion would lose his tongue because Jaime lost his hand and Theon lost his Johnson. You know, like, there was this running theme of...
And Cersei lost her beauty and her kids.
Exactly. Yeah, and like, the loss was obviously a theme that ran through Game of Thrones. And and some people even go so far as to suspect that there were people... that they were planning to cut out Tyrion's tongue if he wasn't such a entertaining on-screen presence for other people.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just fan talk, so, you know. But
there's also a lot of suggestions in the book that that might happen. I think Ultra FX has done a whole video on how Tyrion could potentially end. And I think he said something like he counted the number of times a character, like he's had the threat of having his tongue cut out. I think it's in the mid-20s in the books. Like 20 times has someone threatened to cut out Tyrion's tongue. And it would be a fitting thing for him.
Yeah, yeah, it would match him. So in light of that possible theme, and I don't expect we'll see this happen in the House of the Dragon, but as what would Daemon's equivalent of that be? Because a lot of it is
dragon.
Nah, I think I mean Daemon's dragon is not his personality, right?
Well, it's a representation of his Valyrian heritage, which I think is powerful to him. I think he cares more about his prestige as a dragon knight than he would as like Rhaenyra's husband. I think if she were to die, he would grieve, but it wouldn't be something that would fundamentally mess with his character. I feel like losing his dragon would lose a chunk of his personal identity.
Like, not his
sword, Black Sister.
Maybe losing the sword?
I don't know. Maybe, like, because I think going back to what you say, like, in this world of a particular type of toxic masculinity, he excels at, and that's, like, I suppose a more characterful trait, right? So, you know, like, I don't know, his brain, really, isn't it? Like, he's quite, like, I don't know. Smart's not like the right word to use because a lot of it comes from character and charisma and social manipulation.
Yeah, I'd say charisma. I don't know what would happen to lose that for him. I don't know. Maybe I think he'd have to lose his whole. I'd be interested to see what I can't think of a perfect answer. I think like as long as he's like. I think he'd have to lose quite a few significant things, not just one. Like, I think he'd have to lose his dragon. I think he'd have to lose his sword. I think, one of the things I think would seriously take him down a notch would be if he got a similar illness to Viserys.
Yeah, he wouldn't be able to do anything.
Physical degradation.
Oh, okay. Like, leprosy or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, something that lost his ability to be a proactive individual because so much of it his drive is his natural id to be constantly moving, constantly doing things.
That's what he values the most, probably.
Yeah, I think if something took away his ability to be active, I think that would maybe be his thing.
Bingo. Hey, like nice,
what
good
most,
one.
What would he be
there we
most,
go.
Most ashamed about happening to him, or feel the most shame about? Where is he the most fragile? But yeah, that sounds like if you took that away, humiliated him, he'd be even more angry, do something crazy, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd be scared of the initial reaction. In the same way, I'm quite scared of Rhaenyra's initial reaction to the news. Like I am psyched for season 2 because it's going to be fire and bloody.
She's going to
do something. Yes.
We're going to have to wait a little bit, though.
Yeah. So, speaking about people that have lost body parts, I'm going to be straight up. I think the Emerald Eye is goofy as heck.
Yeah. I mean,
I think it's not
one of those things that in the books could be really cool.
First of all, the one thing I don't get about it is. Why have an emerald eye if you're going to put an eye patch on it, right? Eye patch or emerald, right? Pick
one. Yeah, if you want people to see it, it's going to be so fancy, right? Why do you put an eye patch on it?
Yeah.
Is it supposed to intimidate, I guess? Or
We have no prior backstory to if this emerald has any kind of benefit or anything like that.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, it's not entirely outside of his personality because Aemon's... like he is kind of that like peculiar sort of.
He's got like
a teenager, right?
Hipster vibes.
Yeah, yeah. Like teenage hipster, bit goth kind of, you know.
He like, wants people to be like, "Dang boy, you cool."
He would be that kid in school that wears the long leather coat, right? Like,
it looks like he should have like a bow or something with a long leather coat.
Yeah, or like walks with a cane and a top hat, like that type of. Like just wants people to look at him, but then can't quite pull it off sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, like he's got that smiled awkwardness. And if that's by design, then because he is, how old is he now? Like 17 or something?
Yeah, mid-teens,
18, 19. Like he, yeah, like that's kind of, that kind of makes sense, you know, like that's kind of the age. You're still working out the finer points of who you are at that age. So I you know, that's kind of understandable.
Starting to care about the signals you send out to other people with what you wear and how they perceive.
I mean, possibly to the point where you overthink it, right?
So and
like the emerald has been something he's been chewing over in his head for forever, and then other people just think it's, yeah, it's a, I don't know, I kind of felt like it was a bit weird.
Did he say why he picked it at all? He didn't really say much. I can't remember.
I think it's just a cool visual thing where he says
something about
like
making it a gift to somebody.
It's a sapphire.
I'm
not sure what significance it might have. I think just thinks it looks badass, so he's it for a cool reveal.
Well, it gives him something to have on the little chart at the beginning, right?
Yep.
I'm sure people wouldn't want to look at an empty eye socket, you know?
Well, that's why he's got the eye patch, isn't it? Right?
Like, I think eye patch or sapphire. I think it would have been cool if, like, instead of him revealing it mid-scene, it could have been a thing like maybe Viserys didn't like him doing something like that, and because Viserys is wearing a mask, maybe he wore an eye patch. And so if we started the scene in Storm's End with him not wearing, like, if his reveal to the scene was him without the eye patch, wearing with the blue eye,
yeah,
then that could be in a my dad's dead, I now like dress how I want, mum, like I'm cool, look how cool I am with my eye, like,
but
I
reveal
don't
to camera
no more.
Okay, well, they revealed it. It was part of the scene, right? That was the purpose of it.
Exactly. Like, if it was a reveal to camera in a separate scene, as like what Jenny just explained, it would make a little bit, again, a little bit more sense. But the fact that in the middle of the hall in Storm's End, he just pulled it off and go, da-na! Like,
anime. It was meant to add to the whole little beginning confrontation.
Anime.
Yeah,
sorry,
I mean,
what, Max?
I said it was very anime.
Yeah.
I think the only logical reason I can think of it for being in this scene, which is not a perfect solution, I still think it's a bit cheesy, is it's an intimidation technique, and it's a really obvious reminder for Viserys of, like, before I cut out his eye, I'll show him what he did.
It's not a perfect solution.
Yeah, yeah, I want your eye.
Eye for an eye.
Like, that sort of thing. It'd be a gift. I think he said it'd be a gift for his mother, so maybe his mother gifted him the blue eye. I don't know. I feel like they could have made it, like a cool character moment in that, like maybe, like, Aegon, always, like, never, like, maybe, Alicent never liked the blue eye, but Aegon does, so now Aemon's like, Aegon's king, I can do what I like. Or maybe Viserys never liked it, but now Viserys is dead, he can do what he likes. Like, you could have had a moment like that where it's like I can do what I want, I'm cool. But that's not how they presented it in the show. They presented it in a nod to camera way, which is fine.
It was supposed to express some of his insecurity about it. Like, he still feels real bad about losing the eye.
Yeah. Well, it could be going back to Game of Thrones season one, like, you know, wearing your insecurities as armor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've lost an eye, which I'm insecure about, but you know what? I can put a cool gem in it, and then I'm super cool. But it doesn't feel like he's insecure about his eye as such. I feel like of his insecurities, that's not necessarily one that he's that peeved about. Like,
probably
I think there
not.
Are other
I mean, he's had
he's insecure about.
He's probably more ticked off that, like, it's gone fundamentally unpunished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, like, he's probably reconciled the I've lost and I gained a dragon, gained a second largest dragon. So he's he's had
Isn't
many
it the
years
largest
to...
dragon?
Yeah, it's the largest living dragon.
Oh, well, yeah. There we go.
It is.
I think Valyrian was bigger, but Valyrian's been dead for 20 years.
there you go, right? Like, I mean, and he's had, what, like 10 years or whatever to reconcile it, so...
Yeah, he should be securing himself by now.
Yeah.
Maybe he's not.
I mean, maybe it was like... Maybe it's a gift from Alicent which made him insecure. Maybe it's something like that. Or maybe, like, Aegon gifted to him, and then he's like, oh, I thought I was over this, but maybe I'm not because my brother's saying it looks gross. I don't know. There could have been a cool emotional reason for it, and instead it just felt like a nod to, and a wink to the camera. Pun intended, because it's an eyeball. It felt a bit. Up to the camera more than a cool moment, but who knows? Yeah. I'll be interested to see. So, question for you guys. So, they've talked in the books about how it's like, it's all about like different perspectives, and how there's no like the truth of the matter is something that is, you know, gossiped about, and there is like no tangible evidence as to how this dragon battle went down except for what we have been presented with in the show. So, the people on Storm's Edge don't know exactly what happened other than Lucerys is dead. Aemond knows what happens. Do you think Aemond is going to say, oh shit, it was an accident, crap, oh my god, I didn't mean to his mother and his brother, or is he going to be like, he totally insulted my honour, so I totally killed him because I'm totally a badass from that badass dragon. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you think he's going to play that off?
So obviously you can interpret his expression after it all happened. You can sort of you can interpret Aemond's facial expression in a number of ways. I don't think he felt guilt.
He had an oh shit face
because I think that oh shit face is oh shit, I've just started a war.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. So I suspect, but again, I'm only just sort of going with my gut on this one, that he's going to be like, oh shit, that was an accident. And then I think Alicent will be like, they'll never believe you. You've got to, we're fucked. Yeah.
Do you think he feels like any shame for what he did at all?
Only insofar as that he feels maybe a little bit embarrassed that he lost control of his or he didn't have full control of his, you know, like he's only looking at it in how it interprets on him. He has no guilt because
he doesn't care that Lucerys is dead. He does care that it may affect his standing as a dragon rider.
He's worried about the fallout.
There's no empathy in that situation at all. Yeah, it's
he's been raised to consider. He's been raised to fundamentally, I mean, consider Lucerys and Jacaerys and Joffrey as enemies, really.
Yeah.
Rivals, if not full blown enemies. So yeah, So he's not gonna, and I don't think Alice. You know, it's not like Alicent's only gonna also care in terms of how it will affect the political situation.
In terms of parallels forward and back as well, we've talked a lot about how Daemon and Aemond are quite similar, both in dress and kind of edgelord vibes, and how Viserys wasn't suited to be king, and Aegon isn't suited to be king. And there was a scene where Aegon came back, where Daemon came back from the Stepstones and presented the Crab Eaters. Axe and everything, and Viserys and he briefly reconciled. And Viserys was talking about like anecdote about like her, your mum. I will take no doubts on this. Our mum definitely loved you more. You were definitely her favourite, 100%. And I feel like if we are drawing parallels, Aegon is definitely not Alicent's favourite. Aemond is definitely her favourite. Maybe Helena, but in terms of sons.
Mm-hmm.
Alicent's favourite is definitely Aemond.
Yes.
So yeah. I'll be interested to see whether or not the oh fuck, you just started a war comes into her perspective on her sons. Because Aegon is a shit, but he hasn't actually done anything to start a war yet.
Oh, is she going to play? Is she going to switch to a new favourite? Yeah.
I don't know, because like she desperately pities Helena and she desperately wants Helena to be happy.
Right.
But between the boys, she's definitely showed a favour over Aegon.
So which,
In terms of parallels between the mother and the two Targaryen boys, you can definitely draw that connection.
That's an interesting thought, especially...
Which one's going to bring her more shame?
Who knows? Well, because now Aemond is a kinslayer.
Yeah.
That's significant. Oof. Like, he's not a rapist, but he is a kinslayer under the rule of the Seven. He has committed a unthinkable act and also started a war.
Maybe that's his reason for blaming it on the dragon, possibly, and saying it was an accident. So that
and also
she stays in favor with Alicent.
Yeah, given that Aegon might possibly warm up to being king, right? We saw him warm up to it in the dragon pit where he is crowned. But if he warms up to it a bit more, then it might win Alicent's favor, and then so it could be like, you know, and especially considering like Alicent is also kind of horrible, you know, she overlooks some pretty
very self-involved, very inward,
very yeah, yeah. Like she's
very unself-aware,
yeah, no empathy, yeah. Little
so it
lots
doesn't
of shame
feel
flying around.
Does it feel... Also, by the way, just want to point out on the episode, Jenny totally called it that it would be all greens last week, all blacks this week.
Yep.
I also called problems with the pregnancy, and I also called when Aemon said, I will feed you to my dragon.
Yep.
Mm. So, yeah, well done. good observations.
A small snack for the largest dragon.
Yeah.
It's not enough to quench hunger at all.
I mean, clearly she wasn't that hungry, because she dropped most of it. She's a real sloppy eater.
Well, it's wings, isn't it? Wings is messy and not much meat.
Yeah, I know, probably a bit bony. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just bones and skin, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a young dragon, too, so it's probably not a lot of bone at all.
Mm. So, bless. And... I liked how they did that. I liked how they did it. They didn't overlap the time. It's both chronological, but the story is mirrored. That's really clever. I'm very what's interesting is
because I got thrown off in the first shot because they had the previously on, and I was like, oh, they're going to echo shots of this empty abandoned castle as they find out about things, and it was a previously on, and I lost my pride in my thought.
They showed the reaction to the news, because the news had to take time to arrive. And Rhaenys was the one that delivered it, right? Wasn't?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what I think is an interesting possibility is with the way that it's set up right now, Rhaenyra is seen as the good guy and Alicent is seen as the bad guy. But we know, for example, that Rhaenyra's kind of going to go a bit more aggressive.
Bad blood.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the first, like, cause she said she wouldn't strike first, and I think this is the indication.
She's like, I'm
as
not
much
gonna
as
start
as
nothing.
Much as it, all right, as much as it, as much as it was an accident, as they're gonna probably say, they started it. So yeah, she's gonna finish it because that's what she wanted to do.
So yeah, it'd be interesting to see if there's any kind of I don't know if it can be U-turned, but whether or not this goodwill that seems to be being sort of generated for Rhaenyra in terms of, like, even in the later end of the season where she's talking about refraining from war and all the other stuff and like being a kind and attentive mother who, you know, she genuinely cares for her children is sympathetic to Laenor as well. Like she is presented as a good character who
my theory is in the same way that Larys has been the devil on Alicent's shoulder, I think Daemon is going to be the devil on Rhaenyra's shoulder. I think he's going to do things that she's going to concede to again and again and again until it's just as it is because she's angry and grieving. I think he's going to do things that she will say, you shouldn't have done that, but also subconsciously at the very least be like, yes, I did want that. I think he's going to do bad shit in her name because he wants to do bad shit anyway.
And people can be manipulated pretty easily when they're, grief-stricken and angry, you know?
Can Laris do it? Like, he, at the end of the day, though, he's he is just an arsonist. Like, has he done anything that's not arson and feet? Feet and arson, that's his two things. You know, like, it's clever to begin with, but once you kind of have seen how the sausage is made, you know, you've got dragons. They're much better at lighting things on fire than Laris.
They are, but he's not controlling the dragons. He's controlling the people, you know, and if he can...
Well, he's controlling the arsonists. They're like dragons, but they just, like, scuttle on the floor.
It's not how many dragons you have and the size of the dragon. Use the dragon.
So I'd be interesting to see if Laris has a few tricks up his sleeves or something like that, I guess.
He probably does. He just wants those feet, you know? All for the...
But what a daft motivate. Like, can he be motivated by something? This, you know? Like, I get that it's supposed to be like, oh, it's a power thing, but like, even still, do you know what I mean? Like,
I wonder what that says about what Laris is.
He's not murdering his own family for feet. Come on, like, that's just silly. It's just maybe a front for something else. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, like, I mean, there is one theory I've heard that he's not actually that into feet, but he loves making people really uncomfortable so he can kind of grind them down to their lowest common denominator. And what better way to make Alicent uncomfortable? To do that? Like, there's this pious queen who is clearly never actually had a sexual awakening, has zero imagination. How best to bring her down to the lowest common denomination is to, like, not only stand against every time she goes, no, we don't, I don't want you to kill people, oh, no, slowly grind her down into saying, yes, I want people murdered, yes, I want this to happen. And then also lowering her morally and, like, just making her disgusted.
Yeah.
Like, it's petty, but I'd say that's less petty than just liking feet. Like, if his play is to make people feel disquieted and vulnerable, then getting her barefoot and, like, conceding is quite an effective power play for him. Like, he's the one with the power in that situation. Like,
that's
one interpretation, which makes it a bit less just... Naff.
I think the only redeeming thing for it for me would be if it turned out to be a red herring, which it might be, and he's got some other motivation. I just want a serious, like, even bringing people in a, like, so I talked last week about Locke in Game of Thrones. I think that was on the podcast where, like, his motivation and his actions lined up in an interesting way. Locke just fundamentally hated rich people because, I mean, you could say maybe there's some jealousy there, or maybe you could just say that he doesn't like the injustice, or however that he chooses to express that. And he does outlandish things like chops off Jaime's hand and the rest, you know, torments him basically. And that, it makes a lot of sense. He is humiliating powerful people because he almost sees it as the tables turning in a, you know, in a some short moments, and you, I suppose you could apply that to Laris, but
I mean, watch the rich burn a little bit, you know.
That's yeah, but also maybe. Like, yeah, I guess I don't know. I'd like to see more, like, not like more like
more feet.
No, more.
Like,
you would like to see more depth and more interest and something more justified than just feet,
Or even just superficial power play. you know, like something a bit more material, I guess. Like can you ask for a castle, or can you? But then he doesn't care about legacy, so he probably doesn't care about a castle. I mean, what? Like, I want the guy to care about something. That's all. Is he just a nihilist? Is he like the Joker?
Yeah, he just wants to watch the world burn and wants to mess with people.
But that doesn't make sense, right? Does it?
maybe he'd be really into Helena and Aegon's kids because they have 6 toes on their feet. So maybe that's his little <favorite.
laughs> He's looking for kid feet. What if he's into kid feet?
There was a couple of podcasts ago where I was like, you know what? Isn't it weird that there's less Targaryen birth defects, like, given the amount of incest?
Yeah, I thought about that, too. Like, come on, man.
And so we finally have some Targaryen birth defects.
Cousins other than, like, and sisters having
kids having kids. Like, yeah. Ugh.
Brothers and sisters. Yeah. Family, yeah.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, Aegon and Helena's kids, I think they both have 6 toes on each foot, and the son and the boy has 6 fingers on one of his hands or something.
Yeah, well, that's in the book.
I feel like there should be more problems than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the question is, are there problems in the way that, like, some of them are psychotic? So the Targaryens are completely and utterly crazy, and some of them have horrendous birth defects because, like, you know, their babies come out all scaly and dragon-like and twisted.
Only time will tell, right?
Like, so there are Targaryen birth effects, but having, like, classic relatable, or as close to relatable as possible, like, our world style birth defects with webbed feet and all of that, that seems relatively rare. So it's kind of nice. It's nice that their sigil on the blood chart is 6 fingers, 6 toes. Did you guys see that?
No.
Is
yeah,
it?
Like... Yeah, that's their sigil for the siblings. Is they have a crossed a pair of hands with 6 fingers.
Oh god.
Both of them are identical on that one. They both have the same. I think
my name is Inigo Montoya.
You killed my dragon. Now prepare to die.
I'm prepared to die.
Yeah. So it's nice to have some. Well, not nice because incest, but. You know, it is something that I was slightly confused about, the fact that so far the Targaryen seem to be free of the classic birth defects. So at least they're doing some birth defect representation.
Mm-hmm. And of course, did you say does Jaehaerys have 6 toes?
Jaehaerys and
Yeah, Jaehaerys.
Yeah, I know. I'm not confusing at all.
Lexi is a nightmare.
There's Jaehaerys, who just flew off to the Eyrie in Winterfell. But Jaehaerys is the son of Aegon and Helena, and the twin of Jaehaera.
Jaehaerys and Jaehaerys.
Oh, no, I mean,
and he's the great grandson of King Jaehaerys.
That's the one, Jaehaerys. Yeah, the guy at the very
beginning.
Someone
needs to make a tongue twister out of all of these names.
So somebody probably has.
There needs to be like a great, the great Targaryen grandson. Names are like
just
a
Google
horrifying
it.
Rap.
Yeah, and the old guy, the very old guy, King Jaehaerys the first of his name. Like that. Yeah, I think I might have heard somewhere that he has an extra finger or toe or something.
It's amazing that we've come completely full circle now with the with at least one name. Or two. We got Viserys. No, we got Viserys as well.
We've got Aegon, and Aegon.
Yep.
And Daemon.
Anyway.
Yeah.
How many Baelons have we got? Oh, we've got a Baelor, a Baelon.
Well, there is... Baelon is dead, but was married to Alyssa, and then we have Baelon that was one of Viserys' kids that's dead.
There's just going to be a Baelor eventually.
They should try and invent some new names.
Yeah.
The dragon.
Mm.
Joffrey is the one with the most different sounding name.
Yeah.
They made a point of that it wasn't a very Targaryen sounding name, because it
definitely
was named
not.
After Lucerys... What's it called? Laenor's boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But ironically, I suspect Joffrey obviously has okay enough standing to probably be the namesake of Joffrey from the Game of Thrones series, or the Game of Thrones timeline proper. So he must have, or it's a common enough name. It's either a common name, or it's a name enough that Cersei, who was choosing the name of her child, decided to name them after a historical prince who, at the moment, hasn't really done anything of note. He is, like, six, but, you know.
Little boy.
Well, now he's heir to Driftmark.
I suppose if you're a history... I was going to say a history buff, but to be fair, someone like Cersei would probably have had a reasonably comprehensive history education on family lines. And
She was a fine lady, so she would have read about knights and lords and
kings. So Joffrey Velaryon is a non-Targaryen royal name. So I suppose if you were looking for... if you were having a child with the expectation that he would become king, then Joffrey is probably literally the closest non-Targaryen Valyrian name.
It's probably mostly legitimately royal non-Valyrian name. Yeah.
She would have specifically avoided calling her son a Valyrian name because Robert hated the Targaryen so much. Okay. Yeah, it makes sense.
And there's a good chance that, like, what's his name? King Robert might not have known Joffrey Velaryon. Like educated, like, people might have. Like, for example, Shireen would know who Joffrey Velaryon is. But, like, Robert was probably, you know...
drinking and whoring.
Yeah, like, he was out, or probably at that age, more like skipping school to hit stuff with a stick, right? But, like... you know, he was not known for his intelligence. He was known for his prowess as a fighter.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm now living in doubt of whether or not any of these children will survive, because war hath arrived. And we know the Targaryens are decimated in some shape or form, and the dragons are definitely depleted, if not lost, at some point during this conflict, because we know that from the future timeline, that there are not dragons and there are very, very, very few Targaryens. So when it comes to those factors, it'll be interesting to see whether or not Prince Joffrey actually does anything, or whether or not he's just a prince who existed, who had a name.
Yeah.
The prince who existed.
and had a name. Yeah. Like, you will meet a man and he will have a hair. Okay, cool.
What is this guy? Oh, he existed young and he had hair and a good name. That was it.
And a name, yep.
He didn't win the lottery.
These are things that are factually true and could be factually true of most things.
Well, look how many people are dead already. Before the war even started.
Yeah, we're setting the bar real low.
Oh.
Right. I've got a couple more things if you guys want me to reel through my list of things that I made while we're chatting. So did Rhaenys ever actually bend the knee to... So one of the things that they've held true so far, at least between this episode and the last episode, is they're holding true to some form of traditional gentlemanly conduct, in that if you will not be called an oathbreaker if you swear allegiance to one side or the other, unless you then backtrack. Right. So I think Rhaenys might be hedging her bets. Unless I missed it, I don't think we saw her bend the knee. So I think she's still holding on to the ability to choose her path at a later date if needs be, dependent on what happens.
I don't know.
Like, I think I'm not doing her dirty, because I think it's, you know, strategically smart to not necessarily hitch your horse to the first hitch your cart to the first horse. you know, I think her main prerogative was, can we have peace? Can we have peace? Can we have peace? Now, that's unlikely to happen now that one of the children has been killed. But I think she was hoping that she wouldn't necessarily have to choose a side.
Was I right in thinking that perhaps the reason she didn't kneel was because she hadn't discussed it with Corlys?
Corlys.
Yeah.
And Corlys did bend the knee. Corlys did say, you have our loyalty. So I don't know whether or not she's taking him as a sign of her dedication, but I don't physically think I saw her bend the knee. And
she
so
did
I
not bend the knee,
know.
No.
But she said after talking to Corlys right at the table scene that she was going to use her dragon to assist them, and Corlys said he would. Well,
yeah.
Could it be that, like, for someone of her seniority, she basically gets a pass because she's basically the grandmother of the Targaryens.
When Rhaenyra got given the crown, everyone bent the knee to her, including Daemon, except for Rhaenys. And that I don't know, it felt significant to me. It could mean nothing, but it was just one of those things that they drew attention to the fact that every single other person at the baby's funeral / the crowning bent the knee, except her. So it might have been that she was waiting for Corlys. It might be that she hadn't chosen yet. I don't know, but the fact they drew attention to it felt significant, and I don't know whether or not that's going to have a fallout, particularly if Rhaenys is going for peace and Rhaenyra is going for wrath in the next season.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I
it was meant to like make them feel like they're a little more on equal ground than everybody.
Maybe.
Yeah, there's a few ways it can be interpreted, and I don't entirely know which is the best way, and whether or not it's designed to be a little bit ambiguous, because it doesn't seem like a disrespectful or defiant stand. Yeah. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it could, like, maybe her knees are getting a bit much, and just a soft curtsy. And maybe because of her age, or not because of her age, because of her state, you know, status as a sort of
seniority
as a, like a pseudo grandmother, right? Like, not necessarily grandmother, but like a great aunt, or she's got that kind of thing that it's like, you know, people at the very least trust her to be upfront about her intentions and to not be underhanded. So maybe she kind of,
I think she has a reputation for honesty, which is refreshing.
Her general status probably affords her the privilege not to have to kneel, providing she's not being a dick about it, right? You know, put like defiant or like angry, or, you know.
Talking of loyalty, there was a scene where Daemon took Jace to test the Kingsguard's loyalty to Rhaenyra with the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it was he wanted it to show him what real loyalty is. But instead of showing them what real loyalty is, he kind of showed them how to threaten someone into submission.
Right, that was not real loyalty at all. There was an outside force that was forcing them to...
Exactly.
So, you want to get torched, or you want to be on our side? You know, it's like...
Ironically, real loyalty would have been if they said... actually, we think Aegon should be king. Kill us. That would have been the way to show true loyalty. I don't know whether or not Daemon was... I think Daemon was basically pitching for a fight because he was angry and has no emotional control, and was really hoping that either of those guys would flip so he could invoke violence.
I suppose to Daemon, from Daemon's point of view, and to... you know, in line with Daemon's values, loyalty probably does derive itself from a degree of fear. Like, even when he was with the gold cloaks, you know, we don't know to what degree he whipped them into shape with a bit of you know, drill sergeant mentality, right? And dragon.
Well, I guess I mean, that's fear.
I don't know. It was just something that it was interesting to me that it felt ironic that he was describing it as how to show real loyalty, when actually what he was asking was, are you going to die, or are you going to reassert something that I can't prove to be true because there's a threat of death. Like, you know, it's right. Like confession under duress. Yeah. Like,
exactly. It's like back the person to a corner and then give them two options instead of letting them actually choose with no outside manipulation or force.
But I mean, obviously, it needed doing to see if the Kingsguard would remain loyal to Rhaenyra, but if I was the Kingsguard, I'd go, the psycho just threatened my life. Maybe I should go to the side that doesn't have dragons that have just been threatened to kill me. I don't know. I feel like it might be one of those dragons used for personal gain that might cause conflict later, in the same way that Rhaenys killing some peasants is fine for the moment, but might cause problems down the road.
Yeah, well, I think with Daemon, he is one of those people that thinks that Aegon the Conqueror won because of dragons and that he did everything he could because of dragons. Like, to Daemon, all power comes from the dragons as a show of force.
Right.
You know, people aren't going to be... People aren't gonna bend the knee because they think you're a nice guy, or even because they think you're like the best ruler or king or whatever. It's always going to be a show of force with him, and I, you know, that extends to loyalty as well, I suppose, right? And that's where he contrasts with Rhaenyra, in that Rhaenyra is a she doesn't
an empathetic ruler.
Yeah, she doesn't see force as the be-all and end-all and the first tool in the box to use, right?
Yeah. It's the and I think it might be interesting, again, I feel like he'll be a brilliant little devil on her shoulder, and I'm kind of interested to see how far he can push it before she realises how far she's gone, because, again, she's in a state of grief. No one knows what she will do in this circumstance.
Yeah, it's like Otto and Alicent, sort of. To get angry, you get manipulated. Usually
Right. A super quick couple of ones. So one, the standoff on the bridge was almost shot for shot, like the standoff on the bridge where she saves Otto from being killed by Daemon, and she yet again saves Otto from being killed by Daemon, because Daemon would have just killed him.
Yep.
And it's shot for shot, except older and more world weary, and she's on Daemon's side rather than being against him. So that was just one of those nice visual callbacks. There was also one of the interesting things that we've talked about how there's sometimes a theme for the episode, and there was a lot going on in this episode. So I don't think there was a very clear theme, but one of the things I did notice was there seems to be a thing about like men abandoning their women in times of stress. So Daemon didn't come and see Rhaenyra until after the baby had died.
Right.
And there was the point in the episode where they got married, where he talked about men being depraved, and she responds that, like, I know you're capable of depravity because you basically abandoned me. Mm-hmm. Like, you made me fall in love with you and then abandoned me. And so her impression of depravity is abandonment. And he wasn't there when she was having a baby. He was there trying to push for war while she was screaming and calling for him. So I don't know. It just it seems like to highlight the toxicity of some aspects of their relationship. And then obviously Corlys did the same thing to Rhaenys, where at the point where she was deeply grieving, he effed off to go and, you know, make money and do ship adventures and nearly died. So I don't know. It's just it's a theme I noticed, particularly with those two relationships, where the man abandons at the point where things get tricky. In the same way that Laenor was like, when a storm is coming, the smart person runs away or something.
Sails away.
So that's what Corlys says, but Laenor says like you run away. I think Corlys says you either face up to it or go round. And Laenor then uses a similar analogy to be like, no, you run away, you leave. Which is interesting as a father and son dynamic. Right. And my last one is, I don't think it was mentioned in the story, but I think Rhaenyra's stillbirth child was going to be called Visenya. Which makes sense, because she was going to call baby Aegon her brother by Emma, she named her Visenya. That was a name she'd chosen for what she thought was going to be the a little sister to her back when she was 15, because they weren't sure of the gender of the baby. So we can assume that if she'd had a healthy baby girl, she would have called her Visenya, being the first girl that she would have had. And then the bit of paper that Otto brought to her that was torn out was when Alicent and Rhaenyra were reading about Visenya underneath the thing. So, like, I think that's part of that emotional moment is not just Alicent remembered, it's Alicent remembered and I've just lost my child who would have been called Visenya.
That was the, like, plea for peace.
So the plea for peace was, like, remember our relationship we had as a child and how you were breaking the rules, but I remember still, and I kept that page because it still meant something to me all this time, which is a really, like, clever, emotive, manipulative tactic from Alicent, whether genuine or other. I feel like it didn't seem like Alicent had much in a say of what actually the terms that Otto brought, but that was a good, compelling bit of evidence to, like, being genuine in her pitch towards peace. But it was very interesting that I wonder if Alicent had made that assumption that if Rhaenyra was having a girl that she would have called her Visenya, because obviously at this point Alicent doesn't know that she's stillbirthed, but would have still thought, like, for your family, for your baby, let's go for peace. And so that might have been part of the reason why for a minute it seemed like Rhaenyra would have gone for peace, because message was, you've lost your baby, but I remember. Anyway, I thought it was a really a good callback that had deeper meaning in the context of having just lost the child.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all of it. I just also wanted to comment on the costumes being awesome and the fact that Rhaenyra and Daemon totally, like, match their outfits on a couple of points. They were, like, the same structure, just gendered and power couple moves, and super awesome and really cute and awesome. Targaryen, and I loved it. Yeah. Also, the one thing that I found really weird, which kind of reminded me just a little bit of when they depicted Sansa's first period being, like, the bloodiest explosion of all time. The fact that Rhaenyra's in pain and then just reaches under her skirt to see what's going on. Like, they obviously changed the angle, but how that would have looked would have been her literally reaching up her skirt and seeing what was going on. And, like, no one would do that in a public setting. Even if they thought that they were in the process of miscarrying, like, they could have had, like, a shot of her looking down at her foot and seeing blood. Or, I've got to go
why
for
do you
a
think
minute
she didn't
and go
want,
into another
why
room.
Do you think she didn't want any help? Because the last time, right, they helped her?
I think it maybe because she could tell something. Like, the thing is, it was a premature birth.
Right.
No matter what, it was a premature birth. So I think because she knew that it was going to be a dangerous and unsafe labor, she didn't want anyone interfering because she feared what would happen with her mother.
Yeah.
Female midwife or not.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think as well is that it was a metaphor about her feeling like she needed to stand alone in life, or at least stand alone with she'd just become the queen. She's alone. You know, she is now above all else.
I can take it on.
And she needs to stand on her own. She needs to be on her own, even going through that situation. I don't know. Like, the emotional state of someone who's going through a premature, possibly stillbirth, after hearing that her father had died and her best friend had just entirely boycotted her birthright. Those are the two leading theories I have. Is fear of what happened to her mother and feeling like she needs to be herself. But she was calling out for Daemon. She wanted Daemon to help her or to be there with her. But she didn't necessarily want help from the servants. I think it was possibly she knew it had gone wrong. And it was going to be a bad time, and she didn't want them to take it into their own hands of, oh, we cut the baby out or some such.
There were indications in the run up to that scene.
Yeah.
Where it was like
good episode. Very sad.
Do you have any?
When are we? Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Do we have any thought, like any expectations as of yet for a season 2? Anything you sort of you I don't know, hoping to see or just...
War battles?
Yeah, I'd like to definitely see a good battle.
With war coming up, I think that's pretty much guaranteed at this point.
I hope it doesn't all go too quickly, because the thing is, now that it's kind of, it's revved up, I hope it doesn't just turn into just pure war. Like, obviously, it's a double whammy, because if there maybe was a complaint, which is not me personally, but I think some other people might find this season a bit slow and a bit pacing in place, which I thought built great tension personally. But I don't want to then lose that tension and lose the intrigue and the political machinations because it's war and everyone's pissed off at each other and scared. Because I hope that's not the direction they go. I hope they can keep some of the intrigue, as well as obviously amping it up for actual combat and other things. But I don't want them to neglect the things that are interesting politically for the sake of, you know, chits at the fan, let's fight, finish him.
Yeah, I hope so.
So I'm hoping that's not an expectation that comes through.
I would like to see a battle that doesn't have dragons in. I got to admit, I'm not the biggest fan of dragons as a whole. When it came to Game of Thrones, I was much more interested in the direwolves than the dragons.
Are you aware you're watching a show called House of the Dragon?
I get that they symbolize weapons of mass destruction, and that is kind of interesting. And I'm sure they'll take it to some great places. But, I hope that just doesn't become what it's all about, is the dragon fights. You know, like, I'd like to see troops on the ground. I like to see strategy. I like to see interesting dynamics, people using the land to their advantage. You know, I always thought Game of Thrones did battles in a really interesting way, where each battle was different because it had a different layout, different motivations, different types of army with different equipment. And they dropped the ball, I think, in the season 8 when it came to battles. I feel that they could have done more to have made them. But, well, I still remember a fair amount of the Battle of the Long Night and the Bells.
I'm hoping that now that war has started, they don't just go for spectacle over meaning.
Exactly.
Because this season was a lot of meaning with not that much spectacle. There was some, but it wasn't the focus. I'm really hoping they don't just go, oh, well, it's war now, let's just do big spectacle. Because that was one of the most painful things about the last season of Game of Thrones was, you guys want Clegane Bowl? Clegane Bowl! Looks like the side of a van that someone painted with, you know, knights fighting over a city on fire and all that. I really, really hope they've learned that lesson and they don't go in that direction, because that would ruin my interest quite significantly if it just becomes the spectacle show.
Yeah. Although one thing about Clegane Bowl is, as much as I was left unenthused, the visuals of it were beautiful.
I think the visuals were beautiful, but they did also throw me off that they felt like a Rockstars t-shirt. Like it was an aesthetic and it was aesthetically pleasing, but it felt like fantasy does fight. It didn't feel like this is an actual really built emotional moment between these two characters. Mm. One of them's a zombie who ain't got no emotions anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think in story speaking, like I liked the heavy metal vibe that it had.
I can appreciate it for what it was, but I don't want to see that in Hot D.
Yeah, the thing is, I don't think the story should have took it there. Do you know what I mean? Like it was like, it would have been nice to have subverted expectations and to have and for the Hound to have realized that. Well, the Hound did realize that that his quest for revenge was really useless, but he said, yeah, but I've got a contractual obligation to do this Game fight ball. So
I hope that Here we are being like, I hope it's not bad. I hope Hot D's not bad, season two. Well, I'm like, you know, that's how I felt like at the beginning of Hot D, and I've been genuinely excited every single episode. So I'm going to tentatively put faith in the showrunners. What sort of thing do you want to see? We keep saying things we don't want to see. What sort of thing do you want to see?
Just good battles, really. And complexity. Like, at this point, I don't have much in the way of expectations at all, because I do trust the show to be good. I think that I made no bones about it that I was legit expecting good things from Hot D, even though people laughed. They laughed at me. They did. They go, ha ha ha, after how they closed off Game of Thrones for season 8, you're going to be stupid enough to get back on that horse.
I will admit to being one of those gremlins.
But I
can't be seeing the screen captain being like, nope, cast Matt Smith, what? Nope.
And I think Dan and Dave were very much, I think the blame, the Game of Thrones fan community definitely put the blame squarely on those two, and I think that was justified, and I think getting rid of them fixed a lot of the problems.
A lot
of the problems. Can you imagine that they were going to do a show about the Confederacy? That would have been terrible.
Yeah, and, well, I'm just picturing the D&D version of Hot D, and I think they would have taken out, basically would have done it how George R.R. kind of implied that a lot of the characters were, where Rhaenyra is just kind of a bit of a, like, warmongering slut with no real motivation other than she's a bit of a whore. And they probably would have made Alicent's a violent, like, aggressive woman who, like, at the point where she's putting Aemond up for the throne, she says something along the lines of, like, I hope Rhaenyra dies in childbirth. Like, you know, maybe the whore will die in childbirth, is, like, a thing that Alicent is said to have said in the books. And, like, that character would have been far less interesting than what we got. And I think D&D probably would have, if they were to do Game of Thrones, probably would have written them as those less interesting characters.
I also think that, I mean, we could in theory, like, some of the, like, I believe some of the showrunner's self-criticism was making Daemon too likable. Like, they, but in many ways, like, Dan and Dave would have, I think they would have gone all the way in on making Daemon the likable, complicated, fixable man. And I think that would have been really problematic.
Yeah, I think that would have been...
It would have made him the Jaime Lannister.
Yeah. I'm glad. I'm really happy, and I'm genuinely happy that you were right and I was wrong, Chris. I saw the screenshots. I was looking at the costumes. And I was like, nah, it's gonna be crap. And I've really enjoyed it.
I was foolish to pin my hopes on it. I will grant that, because a lot of people were saying, I'm going to expect to be rubbish, and if it turns out to be good, I'll be pleasantly surprised. But I had a gut feeling, and my gut is frequently wrong. So again, not, you know, like I was, but yeah, like, you know, from what I read, from what I, you know, I believe that there were enough good, knowledgeable people on that show to learn from the mistakes, and they have. And if they bring in, and I genuinely reckon in season two we're going to see some levity, some comic relief. I think they will have learned from that slight omission.
They need to bring Mushroom in and take him seriously as a character. That's my one note about this season that I'm disappointed, is that they showed Mushroom in the background, I guess, one scene. But
yeah, it'll be nice to have a proper book. Like a wise fool, which seems to be the archetype the Mushroom is in the book, because he's one of the perspectives. I think having that wise fool who can kind of look at things in an abstract way and actually find the humor. I think when we've talked about this before, I've said it's kind of hard for these characters who are so invested and so serious and so, like, you know, it affects their life and their family. It's very hard for them to be the ones to make witty commentary, because they're too busy being angsty and stressed and depressed and invested.
Mm.
So it'll be good to have a outside perspective who can actually put some fun back on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I think it's good that the biggest criticisms on the whole are things that they've left out, not things that they've put in that they shouldn't have, right?
Yeah, I'm so impressed. I'm honestly, the series has shot right up into my probably top five series I've ever seen. Maybe even top three.
Of ever? Christ. Oh, wow. High praise indeed. Mm. I mean, it probably breaks top 10 relatively easily.
I mean, for me, I love shows which that there is, like, if you can enjoy the content in front of you, but also there is a deeper meaning which you can read into, and I feel like this has cracked that nut. And it's also, it's visually pleasing, artistically pleasing, well acted, well directed, well written, well, like, it, from a production standpoint, it's up there anyway. But then you have to add in the fact that, like, it feels like they know where they're going. It feels like they know what they're doing. Mm. I'm just really impressed. It's discussed deep and troubling issues in a way that I feel is a good balance between serious, like, moralistic tones and also a certain level of, you know, you choose who's right in this circumstance. I like that sort of challenge.
Yeah.
Also, I like that sort of challenge wrapped up in a lovely fantasy bow.
Yeah. In an engaging, fleshed out world as well.
Yeah.
I feel that this series is designed to be talked about in the way that we talk about it. Like, it's, I think they layer things deliberately. And I think sometimes maybe you can that is almost approaching a fault. You know, when they've got things that are just a little bit too open to interpretation. But I guess that's kind of part of the fun, really. So it's not, that's not really criticism. That's really more of a compliment. But, like, sometimes I don't know. It just feels like they're leaning into it a lot. But, you know, I mean, that's what we're here for. So should I really complain?
I feel like that's another lesson learned in comparison to D&D. Because D&D, you got the impression, particularly towards the last couple of seasons, that they were very much anti-fan theory. Like, if fans have a theory, we'll do the fan service version of it, or we will completely and utterly mess with expectations so that we can be edgy and unexpected. Mm. Either it's fan theory that we think is cool and we think will get us Star Wars.
Yeah.
Or
we'll show those Redditors.
And so it doesn't feel like this show has that attitude. I feel like this show is like, if we seed enough eggs, if people read into it, that's awesome. That's great. We're doing something right. Because they have that reason where the story that they're based on is a bit more kind of non-specific and plays with the idea of the unobjective observer. Like, they can kind of tell their own story without being disloyal.
Mm.
Great. I love it. Anyway, I feel like I've been talking way, 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 way too much today again, as always.
Not at all. I think you've nailed it.
I think you guys have nailed it. Honestly, this has been a delight actually being able to hang out with you guys and talk about this, because it's the kind of show you think about on your days off and you're just like, oh, I want to talk about this with someone. So
it's nice to have people to talk about it with, honestly.
It's a pleasure.
I think we're going to ask Matt, because this is like, sometimes I forget that Matt has not seen Game of Thrones.
I haven't.
And
oh,
so,
dang. I've got that too.
So how have you found, just in a nutshell, the show? Like, have you managed to find it easy enough to understand the world?
Yeah, I know the context.
Haven't you?
It would definitely. No, I haven't. I haven't read anything.
You haven't. Okay.
I definitely see how the context would help. Like, knowing more of the universe and stuff from the first series. But it's really interesting to, like, see this first and place it at the beginning of the timeline and think about, like, how this sets into motion the stuff that happens later on. Because it's been fun to sort of, like, get teasers for what you guys have been saying from Game of Thrones. It's been really fun to, like, hear bits of that but not hear the full story. That's kind of, like, motivating me to want to watch. Nope. and to watch the rest of it.
Ironically, though, having watched this, I would not recommend you watch Game of Thrones anymore.
No, I don't recommend Game of Thrones to people anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just read the Cliff Notes summary of it.
or maybe read the book and then, you know, you can kind of visualize as needed.
Yeah, because I do get some of that from... It's just cool. I like when I'm able to start at the beginning of the timeline, not have to hop and try to, like, figure stuff out before or after, but... It sounds like you think this is way better than Game of Thrones.
I would say the failures of Game of Thrones, this has learned from graphically. I will also say...
The relationships in this one sound bad, but they sound a lot more structured and done than Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Some of the areas where I think Game of Thrones is a bit more interesting is I do think that Game of Thrones probably does have like more better characters, but we can wait until season two before we conclude that one, right? But also Game of Thrones shows there's more diversity in geography. There's more places that you see up and down the Seven Kingdoms, and it's a little bit more diverse in scenery, also a little bit more colorful as well. Like they've got the Essos, which is, you know, bright, and I mean, parts of it are Mediterranean, parts of it are kind of like a bit more deserty, and then of course you've got like the Riverlands, and is that maybe like Englandy, whereas like the north might be more Scotlandy. And then you've got Dawn. Dawn's Mediterranean. You'd say Dawn's quite Greek, almost. Oranges, Greek,
lots of orange trees. Venetian, Spain, I'd go with.
Yeah. So maybe Italian-y, you know. So it's, like, it's nice. You've got, like, and with Game of Thrones, with House of the Dragon, we really have just a small section of Westeros, or not a small section, but, like, a bit of Westeros. And I do feel that the scenes... They can be a tad bit stale. You have less because you have such less variety. Yeah. But really, I'm literally looking for things to go.
Yeah, nitpicking.
Very much nitpicking. I hope that with the Dance of Dragons we do see more of Westeros. But you know, I'm having a grand old time watching it, so no real complaints. Yeah.
I had a great time. It's fun to have to talk about
random.
It with
and... thought for you on the subject of Game of Thrones before we wrap up. So there is an anime series called Full Metal Alchemist, and they started an adaptation from the manga to the anime before the manga was finished. And they made an okay ending in the anime, and it was fine. And then, a couple of years later, they made a remake based on the accurate ending as per the manga, and it's infinitely better.
Are you talking about the regular series versus the Brotherhood series?
Yeah.
I've seen them both.
Yeah, would you agree that yes. So
the strange thing, so it is better. The strange thing about the Brotherhood series is
much quicker.
How much faster the beginning is, so they can fit more later. It's so fast. I did like a lot of the latter half of the story though, and Brotherhood was really, really good. Brother and I watched all of it.
So I feel like it's kind of akin to the Game of Thrones series in that the source material wasn't finished when they were trying to make the adaptation, so the adaptation really floundered at the end, but then they did a remake. So my question to you guys is, if they were to remake Game of Thrones, if George R.R. ever actually manages to finish it, but with the mentality of what's been learnt through House of the Dragon, what do you guys, would you guys watch that? Or would you think, it's done? Do you think it would be worth remaking? Do you think it would be worth recast? Like, all of those sort of things. Because obviously it's hypothetical, it's never going to happen. But what if? Because I think that would be great. Because the setups and the payoffs would be... Anyway, it was just a thought that crossed my brain.
Cool.
Good thought to chew on. And they're already making some other... I mean, they're doing the Jon Snow series. Does that take place in only Game of Thrones?
Is that actually happening? That's been rumored for so long. I assumed it was a hoax.
I don't know. I think
it was... And it was Kit Harington's people that have presented the idea. But I think they have recently shelved two prequel shows. I think I can't remember what they were that they shelved, but they were quite distant from the mainstream Game of Thrones plotline. And they were getting a bit worried that, you know, straying too far away from recognizable stuff in Westeros is going to lose the interest of the casual viewer, in a similar way to how Andor seems to be struggling to retain viewer figures, because it's just not really Star Wars. Like, it's got Star Warsy bits in it, but, you know, and I quite enjoy it, but I can certainly see, like, if you're not a Star Wars fan, you might just sort of fade off.
It's like
it.
It's like too extended away from Star Wars,
yeah,
to get enough of the regular viewer base.
So it sounds to me like they're going to focus on the shows like the Jon Snow show.
Is that in the Game of Thrones timeline? Like, does it go before or after it?
It will go after it,
so it's completely unwritten, so it'll be entirely the showrunner's discretion.
Which I
can't say I'm interested in, given that I wasn't that interested in Jon Snow as a character anyway.
I'd watch it.
I'd watch it just to hang out with you guys and talk about it, to be honest.
I think it's got legs, but they wanted recognizable characters, and also prequels are always a hard sell. I don't know why there are so many prequels, really, because a lot of people find it difficult to become that invested in something where they know how it's going to end. There are exceptions to prequels, but in reality, you want to keep moving forward, I guess. You want new frontiers, and you want the possibility that anything could happen.
So what would the next Game of Thrones be thing that's coming out? Is that Snow series after the next House of the Dragon season comes out, probably?
No, they
probably haven't started working on that yet.
I don't think we have any precise timelines.
Yeah.
I mean, they had like four things in the pipeline, and usually with TV shows like this, they shelve so that they could shelve things that they get a feeling for aren't going to work. Right. You know, when they put like four or five shows in motion, they don't do so with the expectation that they're going to end up with four or five shows. They see which one gets the intrigue, you know, see which one gets traction, see which one is good, and then run with the strongest ones.
And not everything can be a hit.
Well, not everything can be a hit, but you can't. Who's gonna put down the money to make four or five Game of Throneses at once?
Yeah.
You know, that's not to say that the shelved ideas won't come back, you know, or they might not, you know, it's just, who knows what the future holds.
Where all the support and investment goes in.
But I do suspect that we will be seeing a Game of Thrones multiverse, because House of the Dragon seems to be doing quite well. Maybe it wasn't quite the phenomena that Game of Thrones was, but what is going to be, right? It seems to me that it's as good as it needs to be to keep Game of Thrones alive and well. So, yeah, pretty happy all around.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you, folks, for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure on this 10-week journey. And
shout out to Stacey, who couldn't be here, but we love you.
Shout out to Stacey. I think shout out to Max, who might have.
And Max, who dipped out at some point.
Yeah, I think he got eaten by a dragon.
He had to evacuate.
Yeah.
Is that the noise that dragons make when they eat people? The bloop bloop.
The sound of it going down the dragon's esophagus and landing in their stomach.
And I don't think we had Falcon managed to join us for any, but was she here for the trailer?
I don't know if they were around. I haven't talked to them about this show at all. I will have to follow up.
Yeah, but, we've had good views on the podcast. I'm quite happy that we've had a good number of people come in and join and hear our thoughts. So thank you very much to everyone who joined us. That's about as it. It's thank you. You know, we're not sponsored by Raid Shadow Legends or anything like that.
We're sponsored by Lewis Anthony.
Lewis Anthony Businessman is our long-time dedicated world sponsor.
He is our patron. Retrieve our patron.
So, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jenny and Matt. Thank you, Stacey and Max. And everyone else. in the just in general, just people in general, thank you, just general, just broad feelings of gratitude emanating across the world. We'll see you sometime, I guess, right? I don't know. We'll work something out. Right. Toodaloo.
Bye.
Toodles.